I'm Marty Moscoway, and welcome to Radio Times. Susan Cain begins her new book, Bittersweet, with a moving description of cellist Vedran Smilovich playing Albinoni's Adagio in G minor in the middle of war-torn Sarajevo. This was back in 1992. He inspired other musicians to risk their lives to perform on the streets. Here's Yo-Yo Ma performing a selection from the first movement, part of his Songs of Comfort project, which he launched at the beginning of the pandemic. Susan Cain asks in her new book what it is about sad music that so inspires us that we seek it out and somehow feel better. Her book is dedicated to the memory of the late Leonard Cohen. His final album, Thanks for the Dance, is haunting and poignant and bittersweet. Cain also wants to push back against the relentless pursuit of happiness and positivity that's having its moment in our culture, in spite of, or maybe because of, all the tragic losses and crises we have experienced of late. She says there is something meaningful, even life-affirming, in feelings of longing and sadness. Susan Cain was a guest on Radio Times on her first book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and she joins us once again. Susan Cain, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's so great to be back here with you, Marty.
What is this word bittersweet? I mean, we hear the bitter, we hear the sweet. What does that mean to you?
Well, bittersweetness, it's really about the kind of deep understanding that we live in a world in which joy and sorrow are forever paired, and a kind of awareness of passing time and of the fact that everybody who we love best, including our own selves, are not going to be here forever, but that somehow what comes with that deep understanding and with a kind of tuning into that view of the world, there comes with that a deep appreciation of life's beauty and a sense of creativity and connection and transcendence.
So you need them both. I mean, to have that sort of broad-based experience, you need both the bitter and the sweet.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess I spend less time in the book talking about states of joy only because those, I think, are kind of taken care of in our culture. We're very happy with dance music and with joy, and like we're comfortable with that. So there's nothing to say that those shouldn't be part of the picture, but there's this other part of the picture that's missing. And it's the way in which when we tune into states of longing and to the sorrows that are part of this world, there's a way in which that connects us as almost nothing else can.
We heard Yo-Yo Ma doing his performance of this, I think pretty well-known piece of music, Albinoni's Adagio in G minor, and you can feel the music going, down, and you often think of, sadness as feelings that are going down as opposed to being lifted up. And you ask in this book, what is it about sad music that so attracts us? What do you think it is?
Well, it's interesting that you use those words of down and up because many people report, and I've felt this all my life, it's part of what set me off on this quest to write this book, many people feel that sad music is uplifting.
That's right.
And there's a great puzzle in that. Like, how could that possibly be the case, right? And why is it that we would bother to go and watch a movie that makes us cry? And why do we love cherry blossoms, which were selected particularly by the Japanese for reverence, not only for their beauty, but because they're so ephemeral? So what is that? Why do we do that? And
why do we do that, as you ask in this book?
Yeah, well, people report that when they tune into these states, they feel a kind of connection with the sublime. And I think that what's really happening that we've lost sight of in our very secular culture is we are all, whether we consider ourselves atheists or believers, we're all, you could say, spiritual beings who have a longing for a world that's more perfect and beautiful than this one. There's a sense that we belong to a better world than this, in which, you know, perfect love and connection could be realized. And you see this in our religions, like they all express the longing for Mecca, the longing for Zion, the longing for the Garden of Eden. But you see it in secular versions too. You know, there's the Wizard of Oz, and Dorothy is longing for somewhere over the rainbow. This is a very deep part of us. And so when we tune in to this kind of music, we're accessing this part of ourselves that is longing for and could get a little closer to these states of love and truth and beauty.
And also just the sort of ephemeralness, if I can use that word, of life itself. And I do think as you get older, that sense of longing and perhaps loss and even melancholia becomes more real, because you begin to see, you know, that the life in front of you is a lot shorter than the one behind you.
Yeah, excuse me. This has been an interesting thing. So in the book, I have a bittersweet quiz that I developed with the psychologists Scott Barry Kaufman and David Yaden at Johns Hopkins. And it's basically a quiz that you can take, and it asks you questions like, do you get goosebumps regularly? Do you draw comfort or inspiration from a rainy day? Various questions like this. And we found that, some people score much, you could say, higher on this quiz than others do. And for people who score high on the quiz, there's a high correlation between that and people who are highly sensitive, you know, in the words of the psychologist Elaine Aron. So I think some people, these highly sensitive types, are kind of born into this world with a sense of the bittersweet and the beauty of the melancholic. But then for other people, as you're saying, they may not have come to the world wired that way, but life experiences come to them where they start to open up to this other state.
Do you see a connection between introversion, as you wrote about in your first book almost 10 years ago, and bittersweetness?
Well, it's interesting. I expected to find a high correlation with introversion, and we actually did not find that with the quiz. We found the correlation instead with this state of high sensitivity. And this is also complicated because most highly sensitive people are introverts, but not all of them are. And then you can have introverts who aren't sensitive, you know, right. So it's all complex. But that really seems to be where the connection.
And crying at commercials, yes. That was one of your questions, wasn't it?
Yes, it is.
Guilty as charged. What can I say? You dedicate this book to the memory of Leonard Cohen. I happen to be a huge fan of his body of work, and in particular his last couple of albums, when it's clear he's dying. I mean, it's clear he can sense that, you know, that life is about to end for him. And what does his music mean to you?
Oh gosh, I mean, so I have loved him and his music for so many years, you know, from the time I was first introduced to it in my early 20s. It's just been this lifelong love affair. And I never really understood or thought that much about why that was. I was just kind of content to love it and to love him. But as I started researching this book, I learned more about him and his life. And you know, his first act he started as a poet before mm-hmm. he was a musician. Mm-hmm. His first act of poetry was when his father died when he was 9 years old. And he wrote a poem, and he took one of his father's bow ties, and he went out into the family backyard and buried the poem and the bow tie there. And there it remains all these years later. And that was his first creative act. But I think there is a... There's a message in all his music that comes through. It's a message that I distilled into this idea that whatever pain you can't get rid of, make that your creative offering.
You interviewed his son, Adam Cohen, who's been producing his albums of late, and he talked about his dad's brokenness. That was the word that he used. Do you hear that in his music, his brokenness?
Yeah. Yeah, and I should say I wasn't the one to interview Adam. It was actually, I think the interview you're talking about might have been from the legendary producer Rick Rubin.
Oh, sure.
But he did talk about his brokenness, and I don't know how anyone could listen to Leonard's music without hearing it. You know, like the song Hallelujah that became his defining song. You know, he literally speaks about the broken Hallelujah, yeah. And that's what he's really teaching, you know, this idea that everything is broken and everything is beautiful, and these two things exist simultaneously.
Would you say you're a melancholic person?
Yeah, I've always described myself from long before I started researching this book. I'm a happy melancholic.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I'm generally, like, I'm deeply happy with life and contented with life. And yet I'm almost like constantly aware of, I don't know, the sorrows, the longings, the tragedies that exist. Like I can't, maybe the best way to say it is that when I was, in my 20s, I think it was, I came across the Buddhist idea that we should try to participate joyfully in the sorrows of the world.
Uh-huh.
And I could not stop thinking about that idea, like how it could be so that you could actually do that. And yet I think that's kind of a state in which I live a lot of the time, and I've been trying to understand it for a really long time.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I want to make sure our listeners can join us as well. Susan Cain is our guest, and we're talking about her brand new book. It's called Bittersweet, subtitled How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole. We're going to talk more with her after this short break, including about her relationship with her mother. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. We want to hear from you, your stories, your connection to what we're talking about. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Susan Cain about her new book. It's titled Bittersweet, and she joins us to talk about some of the value of feelings in things like longing and even sadness, the connection to creativity and empathy. Well, let's talk a bit about your mother. Your book is about many things, but there are some chapters in here about your family, including your mother. As you describe, when you were growing up, you were extraordinarily close as a mother-daughter duo. Help us understand that early on relationship.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So when I was a child, I really can only explain the relationship with the metaphor of the Garden of Eden. You know, it was a kind of Edenic time. I mean, I loved my whole family, but my mother above all. And she was just incredibly loving and warm and present and great company and, you know, come home every day after school and talk about everything that happened that day. It was just a state of complete love and coziness between us.
Until high school, what happened?
Until high school, yeah. So, I mean, there's so much to the story. There's probably more than I can distill, but I guess to give the shortest version. In high school, we had a... My mother had troubles of her own, and she reacted with great difficulty to my growing adolescent independence. And this is an old story between sure. mothers and daughters, you know, the kinds of breaks that happened during adolescence. Ours was particularly dramatic. I don't know how much of the story you want me to get into now, but it was particularly dramatic, and there was a sense in which it never fully healed or repaired, even throughout my adulthood. There was a sense in which I was kind of in a state of mourning for her and for that relationship that we once had all my adult life.
As you mentioned, when you were little, I mean, just this really close, close relationship. But as you describe, as you become an adolescent, adolescents want their freedom. They want to experiment with things. They're interested in sex and things that maybe a mother doesn't want their child to experience. But it sounded like that love became suffocating.
Yeah, because I would say my mother reacted to that, all the things that you just described, you know, with much more difficulty and anger and sadness than would be typical. And I was caught between my intense love for her and just wanting to do anything that I could to take away her pain. Yeah. excuse me, you know, that on the one hand, and knowing that I was the one who was causing that pain. Believing that I was the one who was causing that pain. It was that versus my equally, or if not stronger, desire for independence sure. and all those different explorations. And I ultimately, you know, chose independence. And that played out very dramatically. And as I say, we maintained a relationship all our lives, but there was a sense in which... Excuse me, I'm so sorry. There was a sense in which we never recovered what we had before that.
Yeah, and I don't want to give too much away, but I think it's important for our listeners to understand you. We went to college. You actually went to Princeton, not far from here, and you gave your mother your diaries to take home, and you were staying, I think, for the summer, and gave the diaries to take home to, I guess, put back in your room or whatever. Well, she read them, and that seemed to be just create this enormous rift in your relationship.
Yeah, I mean, so what had happened was the struggles that we had were a pain as intense as anything I've had before or since. You know, it was like being kicked out of Eden. That's the only way I can think of to describe it. And so I wrote everything down into my diaries. I had kept diaries from the time I was pretty young. And I brought them with me to school. And yeah, as you say, I had to stay on campus for a little bit of extra time. And my parents came to take my suitcases home. And at the very last minute, just as they were about to leave, I took my diaries and handed them to my mother and said, well, you know, will you just take these home for me for safekeeping? Mm-hmm. And really, on a conscious level, that was all I thought I was doing. I thought, you know, she's a trustworthy person. Here are my diaries. I don't want to leave them sitting in an empty dorm room. So I gave them to her.
Yeah.
But of course, she read them. And when I got home a week or so later, that was really kind of the definitive break, after which sure. things were never the same.
Yeah, I mean, she was furious with you. As you said, you trusted her. She read your diaries. I mean, tempting, I think, to read someone else's diaries.
Yes.
And at the same time, I wonder whether unconsciously you wanted her to read them.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that is certainly what anyone listening to this story would conclude.
And so Dr. Freud would say, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, on a conscious level, I can't tell you to this day. You know, I got home and I remember she wasn't talking to me, and I remember calling up my best friend and saying, "Do you think it could be that she read my diaries?" Like, I hadn't even considered on a conscious level that possibility, but I'm sure on an unconscious one, yeah, I wanted to be free, even if freedom meant losing what we had had.
And hurting her, right? I mean, it seemed like you needed to do that to separate from her.
Yeah, and that that sense of having caused that pain was the greatest pain of, you know, having caused her that pain was the greatest pain of my life for many, many years to come.
Well, and we're giving a lot away, but at the same time, we're in the middle of this story. But I think to sort of swing us back to bittersweet, you suffer with what happened with your relationship with your mother, and you know, you go into a therapy group, it sounds like, and cry, you know, every time you think about your mother. But you have some revelations, some breakthrough insight.
Yeah, so it used to be I couldn't talk about my mother, not only to tell that story, but I couldn't talk about her. I couldn't say a simple thing like, "Where did my mother grow up?" You know, like a simple biographical statement about my mother, I couldn't have told you without crying until very recently, because it was kind of like a grief that I had never been able to heal. And in the course of researching this book, I went to do some, I attended this group for bereavement counselors. And we had to, as part of an exercise, just talk about a loss that we had had in our lives. And everybody else was talking about, you know, sort of, I want to say in quotes, actual losses, you know, meaning people who had actually died. But I talked about my mother feeling a little bit embarrassed, as if it wasn't a real loss.
Hmm.
But I could not stop crying as I told that story. And I worked with the counselor who ran that group. His name is Dr. Simcha Raphael. He's an amazing guy. And I worked with him a little bit after that session. And he said to me, I said to him, you know, "I'm a little worried. I'm writing this book. I'm telling this story. I'm going to have to go on a media tour, and people might ask me about this, and I'm afraid I'm just going to be weeping on national radio." And he said, "You know what? Give it some time, because I have a feeling by the time the book is done, you won't feel that way anymore."
Hmm.
And true. At the time he said that, I thought, ah, that's one of those things that therapists like to say, you know, like it all sounds really good. But it was actually true. It was actually true, because there was just something that I learned along the way about this bittersweet tradition, and about how this kind of fundamental separation, these fundamental losses that we all endure in one way or another, that the pain of separation and the desire for a union, it's like this source code of humanity in which we're all connected. And what you learn along the way is love itself does not ever go away. You know, you lose one particular relationship, somebody betrays you, there's a bereavement, whatever it is that happens, it happens to you in its particularity, but love itself is enduring, and it returns in many different forms.
Well, he also says, and I underscored this, you can keep the connection to the generations alive without holding on to their pain. You had family that, you know, that died during the Holocaust. So there was, you know, deep pain that your mother was holding on to. And, you know, as a loyal, loving child, it's easy to want to hold on to their pain for them. But it sounds like he said, you can live with the pain and live your life at the same time.
Yeah, that was an amazing insight that he had. You know, as I was crying in that session that day, he helped me see that that some of the pain I was holding was not only from the particular situation that my mother and I had had, but my mother had grown up in a household that was really very, very touched by the Holocaust, and And that is a pain. And I lost so many family members. I mean, people I never knew directly, but there's a way in which you hold that pain from the generations who came before you. And the great insight is this idea that you can still honor the generations who came before you. You can send your love back to them. You can feel what they went through at the same time that you can understand that your life story is a different one. And that they would want you to have your own life story that is not colored by their pain. And I think becoming a parent also really helps you see that, because
oh, indeed.
Yeah, like you see it so distinctly. You want to give your children your heritage, but you want them to have the freedom to have their own lives and their own stories.
Well, it reminds you of Viktor Frankl, who, of course, you know, survived the Holocaust, but he talked about, you know, searching for meaning amidst unspeakable suffering, tragedy, loss. And one of the phrases that I saw associated with him was tragic optimism, which I think is a little bit this bittersweet that you're talking about.
Yes, it really is. It really is. It's like the idea that, this is a world that includes much more pain and tragedy and evil and all those things that it should. And at the same time, there's love and beauty and joy, and we can turn in that direction.
You know, you wrote this book while the pandemic was going on. And as we know, you know, 2+ years into the pandemic, how many people have lost loved ones? You lost a brother who was a physician to COVID, your father as well. And, you know, I'm so sorry to hear that. How have you dealt with those losses?
I don't know. I mean, these losses, they came when I was really deep and immersed into this bittersweet tradition.
Yeah.
And I call it a tradition because artists and writers and thinkers and philosophers have been pondering this for literally for centuries and all over the world. And you wouldn't know that from the culture that we're living in, that is true, but it is true. And I talk a lot about that tradition in the book. But anyway, I was so deep into the tradition that I really do think that helped in some way. I don't know. It was like at the beginning, in the first wake of their deaths, I just felt like trapped in nausea. I just felt physically nauseous for days, and it didn't go away. But then it did. I don't know. There's a sense of the way in which we're all connected in our losses, and my father's life in particular, he was somebody who was so he just loved so much like beauty for its own sake. So he was a very busy medical school professor and doctor who was working constantly, but he would like come home, and he loved orchids, and so like late at night he built a greenhouse in our basement that he filled with orchids, and he would go and look at them and tend to the orchids. And, you know, he would read organic chemistry textbooks just because he found them so beautiful. And he was the one who introduced me to music from the time I was very little. So when my father was gone, I found myself listening to music all the time. And it was like I was looking for him there, and I didn't find him, but I found this tradition of beauty that he had given to me, and that I think is the way to live.
It's interesting to talk about bittersweetness, if I can put it that way. You know, when we do have this sort of positivity movement and happiness classes, which is an interesting sort of struggle between these two states of being. How do we resolve that?
Well, I think it's a question of being able to feel all of it, you know, of just not being afraid of all of the different states. That's where true resilience actually comes from, is being able to see what's there and feel what's there, and also be able to kind of look forward at the same time. And I'll give you like a very mild version
sure.
of what people experience, but I just had the very bittersweet sensation of my, we have two boys and they went away to summer camp for the first time this summer, like a sleepaway camp. So we had never been apart from them for more than a night or two. And on the first day they left, I felt sort of like overcome with a sense of bittersweetness, not only because they were going to be gone for the summer, but because it was a kind of foretelling, you know, of sure. of an empty nest and all of this. And I just felt it for that day. But then at the same time, you kind of take steps forward. And like my husband and I went and took a vacation together for the first time in all these years. We hadn't done that. And it was so incredible for us having that time together. And that wouldn't have happened but for these bittersweet moments that came along with the acceptance of a forthcoming empty nest. And so all of these things exist together.
Well, I'll tell you what.
So there's a way that you can, you know, feel what you're losing at the same time that you're looking forward to what is to come.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Susan Cain. Again, author of a brand new book is called Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole. Her previous book, titled Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. You can join our conversation. You can talk to us here on Radio Times. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Susan Cain about her new book called Bittersweet, where she argues that our culture's obsession with things like happiness and positivity can make people resist or maybe even deny sorrowful emotions. She joins us to talk about the power of these dual emotions, these bittersweet emotions, and how that allows us to feel sad and happy at the same time, how bittersweet feelings can help us see beauty in the world and even find creativity and transcendence. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Here's an email from Don. He says, regarding your earlier Buddhist quote, this gem from Yogananda gives a nice philosophy of life. Quote, if you see yourself as an actor in this earthly movie house, all you have to remember is to play your part, whatever it is, cheerfully and well. What do you think of that, Susan Cain?
I love that. I love that quote. I have not come across it before. And it kind of corresponds with this parable that comes from the Kabbalah, which is the mystical side of Judaism from which Leonard Cohen derived a lot of his philosophy. And in this parable, the idea is that all of creation originally was a kind of intact and divine vessel, but that one day the vessel shattered, and that the world that we're living in now is the world after that shattering. So it's like the broken world. But scattered all around us still are the shards from this broken vessel. And what each of us can do is notice the shards that have fallen around us and bend down and pick them up. And I love that idea. I find it incredibly consoling and inspiring. Hmm. You know, that also the idea that you're going to notice different shards from the ones that I'm going to notice, but we can each play our part. As the quote that this gentleman sent suggests.
As I was reading your book, frankly, I was thinking about the parents in Uvalde in Texas who, you know, talk about the sort of unspeakable loss, suffering, and tragedy that they are enduring with what happened to their children. How can bittersweetness help them?
You know, I don't honestly know. I feel a couple of things at once.
Sure.
About that. I mean, one is, and I write about this a lot in the book, the way in which the loss of a child is, it's a kind of loss all its own in its magnitude and unimaginability. And I don't want to pretend to offer easy answers for a grief that is so large and so horrible. And at the same time, I will say that I've gotten letters from readers who have talked about how this kind of bittersweet view of life helps has helped them to cope with the loss of their children. I think there is a way of understanding the kind of connection of grief and love that we all belong to, that can be incredibly consoling, you know, and seeing the stories of other people who have endured it and gone through it. And in the book, I tell the story of a close friend, is my sister's mother-in-law, actually. Her name is Lois, and she lost her daughter to ovarian cancer. And she talks about all the different griefs that she went through. And then in the end, she decided, and she went through a couple of years where she like barely left the house. And in the end, she decided that she still had her husband who she loved and other children who she loved and grandchildren. And she didn't want to send the message to those people that they didn't matter still. And so she kind of emerged. And she uses the metaphor of a broken mirror. She says it's like the mirror is still cracked. It will forever be cracked, but you can still see in it. So it's a kind of way of, as the writer Nora McInerney puts it, that you don't move on from a grief so large, but maybe you can move forward, you know, and you carry the grief with you and the love for the one you've lost with you as you move forward.
And I think it's so tempting to, you know, to deny those tragic feelings. I mean, just to sort of wall them off and pretend they're not there. But what you're saying is, at least using your sister-in-law's mother, is experiencing it deeply and then coming through the other side. If possible, I guess.
Yeah, and to know that what the culture is telling us, like this idea that Nora McInerney talks about of moving on versus moving forward. Mm-hmm. Our culture gives us the idea of, you know, get over it, move on, even let it go, which is a lovely and powerful idea, but it can be used to kind of tell you, you know, just get over it. But anyway, there's a way in which instead of asking ourselves to move on, we can ask ourselves to move forward, which is we don't have to let go of the grief. If we're feeling the grief, if the grief is there, and yet we can move forward while we carry it with us and still take steps forward in our lives.
You know, it's so interesting. I mentioned this in the introduction that, you know, we have happiness written into our Declaration of Independence in our founding document, this idea of the pursuit of happiness. And I wonder whether Americans are unique that way, that somehow we feel it is our birthright. And yet, on the other hand, we see levels of depression and anxiety, you know, that we don't have a culture that really helps us pursue that happiness. And yet there it is, you know, in black and white.
Yeah, and it's because we're pursuing it in the wrong way. You know, we're pursuing it by mandating it instead of culturally. We can see from studies that Americans smile more than people in other countries do. You know, there's a feeling you should be out there smiling. Somebody asks you how you are, you should say that you're great. We all know this. We know what's expected of us. But that's not actually the root to true happiness. You know, true happiness comes from being engaged with people and work and life that we love, and to being able to see in a clear-eyed way what life is, and life does include sorrows as well as joys. And then from there, you take all that in, and that's where the true happiness comes from. So it's not happiness that any of us should be opposed to, and it's actually wonderful.
Sure,
that the
nothing
Declaration
wrong with
of Independence aspire. No, like on the contrary, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Like, and it's great it's great in a way that it's written into the Declaration of Independence. I think what's wrong is that we're pursuing it in the wrong way, and it's taking us actually. It's not really surprising that we have these rates of anxiety and depression. I mean, there's a thousand reasons for them, but suppressing difficult experiences and emotions that we have been through is more likely to give us anxiety and depression than it is to create happiness just out of willing it to be so.
I'm going to make a weird segue, but I'm also thinking about this impulse in this country to, you know, to not recognize our own past, you know, the role that slavery played in the founding of our country, whether that's sort of, you know, that a similar denial, a cultural, historical, countrywide, not countrywide, but historical denial of our past, whether that's kind of connected to what we've been talking about.
Yeah. Excuse me. I think it very much is. We are, as we were saying, you know, a country of move on, you know, look forward, like, don't dwell. And there's something to be said emotionally for not dwelling exactly, but dwelling is different from just looking at things in a clear eyed way and seeing what has been. And we know this, you know, that burying things just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I do think that we see this play out, in our cultural history, but you know, it's written into our cultural history. You see it with slavery. You see it also because this is a country also of immigrants who came here willingly, yet often with a desire to leave the pasts from which they were escaping behind them, and never to talk about them. You know, you see that happening often. And so that, too, is written into our cultural DNA.
I think that's really interesting. Here's a comment from Kate. She says, there's a poem by Matthew Arnold that perfectly captures what you're talking about, and it's called To Marguerite Continued. I can't read the poem, but we'll put it out there, and people can look it up. I want to make a really weird segue here. You write about the vagus nerve, about the important role that it plays in what we've been talking about. Help us understand that.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, you have to know the vagus nerve, it's the biggest bundle of nerves in our bodies, and it's absolutely fundamental to who we are. I mean, it regulates our breathing and our digestion. So this is, like, evolutionarily speaking, it's an ancient part of us, and it's a fundamental part of us. Okay, but among our vagus nerve's many powers is that when you see another being in distress, and you feel that too, that's partly because your vagus nerve is reacting on it. You know, it's not even something you're aware of, obviously, consciously, but your vagus nerve reacts to another being in distress. And I think this is incredibly important to understand because we kind of think, or we get the message that the idea of compassion is a kind of Sunday school value, you know, that it's something like you have to learn, and that when you're in a pious mood, that's how you might be oriented. But in fact, this is just fundamental to who we are. And the expression of sorrow is a binding agent. Like, it draws us together. And you know this, like you read a novel, let's say, and you're reading about somebody's distress, and like your whole being is like part of it, and you feel connected and close to that person. So this is one of the reasons that it's so impoverishing to have a culture that doesn't want to talk about this, because this is our sorrows and our longings are one of the greatest mechanisms that we have to draw together. I mean, I often think about this, like, in the context of Red and Blue that seems so hopelessly riven. Like, if we could learn to come together, not through talking about politics and policy prescriptions, but just to tell each other our stories, you know, that's the glue, or that's one of the glues that we need.
Well, what I think is so interesting, too, about this vagus nerve, as you say, tied to digestion, sex, and breathing, but also to empathy. Mm-hmm. So it kind of connects our bodily functions with our emotional life.
Yeah, very much so. And it tells us that we were evolved to react to each other in this way. That empathy is something that we were evolved to feel. And this, by the way, it comes from the work of Dacher Keltner, who's this great psychologist at Berkeley, who I write about. And he talks about how this emerges really from the fact that human beings can't survive without reacting to the cries and the signals given by infants. But because we are built, like literally physically built, to react to the cries of our own infants, from there radiates outward the capacity to react to other people's infants and to our own adolescents, and then just to other people and other beings in general. And obviously we don't always get it right, and obviously there's also a part of humanity that is given to cruelty and hostility, but this capacity for empathy is built right in, and we can build on that.
You say there's a question that has dogged you, and it comes actually from Aristotle: why great artists, philosophers, poets, politicians have melancholic personalities. Have you been able to find an answer to that?
Well, I believe it's because this comes from this deep exploration I've been doing, as I said, of the bittersweet tradition, that there is something about tuning into the bittersweet state of mind that gives rise to creativity, it gives rise to connection, it gives rise to transcendence. And we saw this with the bittersweet quiz that I was telling you about at the beginning, that people who are high, who are high scorers on this quiz, also tend to be high scorers on measures of awe and wonder and spirituality, and of a state called absorption, which predicts creativity. So I think there's something about tuning into that yearning for the more perfect and beautiful world that fuels the creative fires. You know, it makes you want to be, it makes you want to create something that is a little closer to that world for which we long. There's a like turning pain and turning longing into a kind of creative offering. And that's something that we do.
Well, you know, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Time, Susan Cain. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Marty, for having me.
Absolutely. And the book is called Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole. And she was last time a guest on Radio Times almost 10 years ago with a book that she wrote called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times. Under programs, you can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.